Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the race for the presidency, Herman Cain now sits at the very top of the GOP field, number one in the polls. The Pizza King, Mr. 999, the Herminator, can now call himself front runner. He may yet be just another bubble in a campaign that has been full of them. But are you sure? This hour on Point, we're putting the spotlight on Herman Cain. Later this hour, we'll check in on Texas Governor Rick Perry's new flat tax plan. We'll hear from a reporter who knows Cain's Omaha years and from a scholar at Herman Cain's alma mater, Morehouse College in Atlanta. But first, joining me from New York City is David Graham. He wrote Newsweek's big cover story, Citizen Cain. David Graham, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
What's going on with this guy? What's putting him right at the top of the field? You've looked at his whole life story. How do you interpret it?
Well, I mean, he has a fantastic sort of Horatio Alger story, as you mentioned. Rose from living in a project when he was a small child to being a multimillionaire CEO. He's incredibly charismatic in person. He gives a great speech, never uses any notes, and he talks in sort of simple terms that I think connect with a lot of folks.
Here's a little bit of just that kind of talk on his 999 plan at the October 11th GOP debate in New Hampshire.
The 999 plan that I have proposed is simple, transparent, efficient, fair, and neutral.
Simple, transparent, efficient, fair, and neutral. Who could argue with that, David Graham?
Well, when people drill down into it, they have issues. There's a lot of questions about how it would work specifically. But certainly the idea appeals to people. You know, they look at their 1040 and it's impossible to understand. And they hear that and they know exactly what it would mean for them, or they think they would. So it's easy to understand why it appeals.
We're going to look at Herman Cain's policies, but take us into this life story. What is most important for us to understand? You say it was Atlanta. His father, Luther, was a chauffeur for the CEO of the Coca-Cola company. Held down several jobs, talked that CEO into paying him in stock or Coca-Cola stock, which turned out fairly well for them before Herman Cain was grown. But what about Herman himself and what's most important to understand in the life story? We hear these headlines, you know, Godfather Pizza, Rags to Riches. Take us in there.
He focuses a lot just on sort of the importance of hard work and sort of working his way up. When he discusses the civil rights period, for example, in his book, he mentions being aware that he wasn't given the same opportunities that students at the white high schools across town were. And his reaction to that was, well, I'm going to work harder. He got to college, had a scholarship, couldn't keep his average, and his attitude again was, I've got to work harder. So throughout his life, his sort of his mantra has been driving himself, and I think that's a lot of his story. He's just driven himself to bigger and better positions. Each time he ended up in a corporate job, he felt it wasn't high enough and wanted to keep going.
You say he's often gone for more difficult challenges. It's not as though he's just skated in some kind of easy path into the CEO suite. You say that he made choices to actively do the harder thing.
Sure. I think the best example is his career at Pillsbury, where he had risen to be a vice president. He was in charge of the computers and systems there. But he really wanted to be a CEO. He wanted to be a president. And so he left that job and took a job as a management trainee at Burger King. And this is sort of a fast track, and it meant that he was not likely to stay on the bottom for long. But he had to start out flipping burgers and really doing the bottom of the heap stuff. He's in this management program, he says, with a bunch of fresh-faced kids out of college and then people who were Burger King lifers. And they were going, who is this guy? What is he doing? What was his job before? Why is he here? But he wanted to learn the business side of things so he could have the top job at a corporation, which he then achieved at Godfather's.
And he, what, did mathematics for the Navy and a civilian job for the Navy, not an easy job. He was a VP for systems early on with some of these companies, which is not exactly the showboating part of corporate work.
Right, exactly. And he likes to point to that math when he's criticized on 999, for example. He says, my critics have to do the math, I've done the math. And so that's another part of his sort of mantra, is that he's a competent manager and he knows his numbers.
Does that hold up, the competent manager claim? We're going to look at Godfather Pizza chapter in Omaha, Nebraska in a moment here. But your big take, David, from looking over his story, is this a stellar manager and CEO? You know, these days we don't automatically assume because somebody's at the top, they necessarily are. What about Herman Cain's case?
Well, the evidence is generally positive, and I think the Steve Jordan will be able to tell us more about this. At Burger King, he was in charge of turning around a whole region of restaurants. And the consensus is that he did very well at that. These restaurants were underperforming, and he increased their numbers and certainly did well enough that Pillsbury decided to make him president of their Godfather's subsidiary. The evidence at Godfather's is a little bit more mixed. The company was sort of flailing and had been in decline for a long time. And there were worries that Pillsbury would sell it and it would go out of business. What Cain was able to do was sort of arrest that decline, and he, although it ended up being sold to him 2 years later. On the other hand, he did that by closing restaurants. He did that by sort of slashing. And early on, he said he would expand his the chain from 600-some restaurants to 1,000. That was a claim that never happened. So it's sort of a mixed bag.
Herman Cain's autobiography, This is Herman Cain, My Journey to the White House, very confident there, was released this month along with an audiobook version read by Cain. Here's a passage, David, where he's preparing for his first debate as a presidential candidate in the GOP, and he's talking to his strategist, Linda Hansen, about how far he's come.
In the green room, I was straightening my tie, and I looked at Hansen and said, "You know, I can remember when I wanted to make $20,000 a year. And I thought, if I could only make that annual salary, I would achieve my American dream. And now I'm in a presidential debate." Hansen and I looked at each other, both of us thinking, life is an adventure, isn't it?
Life is an adventure, and my American dream, that is not an accidental or unimportant way of putting that, David. You remind us that going to the civil rights mantra of the 60s, we shall overcome. Herman Cain has kind of come at that with an I shall overcome philosophy, the CEO of self, he's called himself.
That's right. It's all about sort of personal responsibility, which jibes well with the sort of conservative mindset of relying on oneself. And that's definitely been his thing throughout the years, is that he will work harder and he will do well for himself.
Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska, where 13 very important years were spent by Herman Cain. Steve Jordan joins us there, reporter for the Omaha World Herald. He's been writing about Herman Cain since 1986. Steve, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. Help us understand the Godfather Pizza story and what Herman Cain found when he came to Omaha way back when to take over the top job in that company.
Well, Godfather's had gone through a very rapid growth period. They were the fastest growing franchise in the country for a few years. But then the founder, Willie Thiessen, sold it. It was sold again, and it started floundering. Some of the other chains, particularly Pizza Hut, were catching up to the demand for some of the thicker, higher-end pizzas that people seemed to like. And so it was really, they had three other CEOs within a space of 4 months, and when Mr. Cain came, he was brought in to sort of do what he could do, and I don't know that Pillsbury had a lot of high expectations for that chain. That's what it was like when he stepped in. They had upset franchise holders who had sued the company. They felt like they were being abandoned. There was really a lot of turmoil in the business, and a lot of increased competition in the pizza franchise business too.
Did he save the business? If he did, how'd he do it?
Well, there is some discussion. One of the folks that I talked to said that it was really a fellow named Ron Gartland, who is still the CEO today, that was a real stabilizing force. But others say that Herman Cain did do some great things. He focused on the marketing. He focused on some other parts. He also promoted Ron Gartland, which is one of the things that Mr. Cain pointed out. You have to recognize who's on your team and who the people are that can do what you need doing. He sort of laid down the law and said, okay, if you're going to be a franchise holder with me, you've got to remodel your restaurants and bring them up to speed. And those who couldn't were cut, you know, sort of less cut out. He was saying they sort of cut themselves out.
And he became known as a showman. I mean, he would step right up, take the microphone himself. There's that famous scene everyone's seen now where he's in a kind of a choir robe singing Imagine There's No Pizza.
Right. It was the Omaha Press Club show, and he did numerous public events like that, some speaking tours he had. That's when he developed this Herminator idea. And then he also gave concerts. He would give benefit concerts for a youth program here in Omaha, and He got recognition. You know, Godfather's was a pretty high-profile company in Omaha. It was a national franchise, which was unusual for us.
Was he seen as a serious man in Omaha, Nebraska?
He was. He was named to the board of the Omaha Community Foundation, which is an umbrella fundraising group. He was on the board of Creighton University here. He was on the Omaha Chamber Board. And then, of course, the Federal Reserve Board that's been mentioned several times in the campaign.
Out of Kansas City, ultimately, then.
Right. And there's an Omaha branch. He started there and then I guess you'd say, got promoted to that in Kansas City, although there's no pay involved in that one, but it certainly is a sign that he was being taken seriously.
So the reputation that he left behind, 13 years, not a small time in Omaha, that reputation, Steve, how would you characterize it?
I think there are people who are proud of him. There are people who think he was mainly a show type person, but, you know, when I asked him about that, he said he still has to try to convince people that there's more between his ears than pepperoni.
So. And pizza sauce. Steve Jordan, stand by in Omaha, Nebraska. David Graham in New York City. We're talking about Herman Cain at the top this week of GOP polls. Mr. 999, his life, his record, his politics. Here he is with his Imagine There's No Pizza. You can join us. Are you on the Herman Cain bandwagon or no? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Herman Cain at the top this week of GOP polls. Your own bootstraps, kind of his message. Here he is on October 5th, sat down with the Wall Street Journal, said that the Occupy Wall Street protesters were trying to distract the country from what he called President Obama's failed policies.
Don't blame Wall Street. Don't blame the big banks. If you don't have a job and you're not rich, blame yourself.
Blame yourself. David Graham, take us back to this moment. This is an interesting moment where Herman Cain begins to get political. It's 1994, and here he is. Bill Clinton's out on the hustings, talking about his health plan. Herman Cain tunes in, and they've got a back and forth. Set that setting for us, David.
Sure. So Cain had become involved with the National Restaurant Association, which is a big trade group which tends to lean Republican. And as he tells it, a lot of his sort of conservative convictions, particularly on economics, came from having to run a business and having to make payroll. And that made him feel that regulations were onerous and that taxes were too high. So Clinton is going around shopping his plan, and Cain is invited to participate in a town hall by a reporter in Tulsa. And he gets up and he says to Clinton, when we institute this bill, if we institute this bill, the cost to employers to insure their employees will be high. It's going to force me to lay off people. What will you say to the people I have to lay off? And Clinton said, well, I think your math is wrong. I think you're mistaken about the costs. And Cain said, Mr. President, I think you're mistaken about the cost. You've done the math wrong.
David, hold the thought. We've got that tape right here. This is 1994, sure. And it may be, we'll ask Steve, this is when Herman Cain got the bug, but here's CEO of Godfather's Pizza talking to Commander-in-Chief Bill Clinton, the Kansas City town meeting.
First of all, Mr. President, with all due respect, your calculation on what the impact would do, quite honestly, is incorrect. Now, let's suppose that 30% of my costs are labor costs, 7.9 times that would be the 2 to 2.5% that you're referring to. The problem with that calculation, sir, is the fact that most of those 30% of the people currently have zero. It actually works out to be approximately 16%.
Steve Jordan in Omaha. Now, there's the CEO of Godfather Pizza and mathematician taking on a president who was famous for his grasp of the details, all the wonkery, if you want to get into it. But there's some chutzpah right there. Mr. President, with all due respect, your calculation is incorrect. What was the significance of that exchange, that moment, Steve?
Well, he's been given some credit for the health plan defeat. I don't know if we really knew it at the time, but Clinton's response was interesting too. Eventually, he said, "Well, we'll get back to you when we figure this out." And I think he was thinking about politics earlier than that. He had developed his Herminator program. I remember seeing it at a at an event in Omaha several years earlier, and instead of his typical luncheon speaker, there was a fanfare that played and a video and an announcer, a recorded announcer, announcing him, you know, and he came to the stage. And so he had sort of a production thing going already. I mean, and then he talked about, I mean, when he first came to Omaha, he registered as an independent. And then he switched to Republican after an experience with Jack Kemp in Harlem when he was going into a meeting and some hecklers said something about how there don't seem to be any black Republicans. And he took that as a kind of a challenge. You know, nobody can tell me what to think. So he, when he was back in Omaha, he re-registered as a Republican. And I think he, you know, he found a political opening there and was thinking about it early on. I mean, he had mentioned possible political candidacy. He even mentioned possibly running for president when he was still in Omaha in those early years.
David Graham, talk to us about the Koch brothers and Herman Cain's political evolution. There have been ties over time to organizations, political organizations that they've backed in a big way. What about that connection? Many people ask about it.
Sure. So in his current campaign manager, in fact, used to be the state director for Americans for Prosperity, in Wisconsin, and Americans for Prosperity is one of the Koch brothers' major sort of political engines. It's been a big grassroots organizer for the Tea Party and for various other protests. It was helpful in Wisconsin with Governor Scott Walker. So they met because Americans for Prosperity was trying to expand across the Great Lakes region, having gotten a toehold in Wisconsin. And they were familiar with Cain, knew he was a great speaker. So they sent him out on the road with this gentleman, Mark Block. And he gave a variety of speeches on behalf of them and connected with Block. Block, now this Americans for Prosperity alum, runs his campaign. And he's given various speeches for them over the years. So there's definitely some interaction, both politically and financially, between the two.
And a relationship that goes back there to the 90s. We're talking about Herman Cain, number one in the polls, CBS New York Times. Here's the latest, even a newer one. This is Quinnipiac. Now, front of the line there, not just 25%, but 28%. This is among Ohio Republicans from Quinnipiac. Listeners, what do you think? Stephen in Dothan, Alabama is calling. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I'm interested in listening in intent because, as I say, Herman Cain, I've heard him on WSB for years since he's been doing the evening programming.
This is his radio years, the Atlanta talk show that he went to after Godfather Pizza and the National Restaurant Association.
Exactly, Neil Boris. So, I mean, he's not somebody new. I've never taken him as a political, I want to get in office, but when you look at everything going on and you look at the whole crop and you look at all the professional politicians, to coin somebody's phrase, you go, really, you know, if we keep doing the same thing over and over again, do we really expect different results? I mean, we're $15 trillion in debt. We have our ratings are going down. Our manufacturing's going nowhere. Our tax code is 3 million plus words. Nobody makes sense of it. Everybody's out for themselves. It's in politics. I haven't seen him once give me that flavor that he's doing this for himself. Maybe he's stroking his own ego, but at least he talks the truth. He talks the breath of fresh air. He doesn't do the doublespeak. He's not going to shake your hand on one side and pick your back pocket on with the other hand. I haven't seen that side of him. And, you know, it's something that's refreshing. Will he make it all the way through? I don't know. But will he keep the dialogue focused on what's really important? Yeah. He comes from an interesting, different background. That is nice.
And Stephen, we've got it. Let me pick it up with my guest right here, and I appreciate your call. David Graham, what about it? There's, you know, Stephen in Alabama watching this, has listened to him on the radio in those years when he was on there, says not in it for himself. On the other hand, there's this line of critique that says he's completely in it for himself, that he doesn't have a serious campaign structure built here, that he's just, you know, building himself up to have a Fox talk show or something. These are sort of polar opposite interpretations of what's going on with Cain. How do you wade into those waters, David?
I think you can't come down solidly on either end. I mean, it's very clear, as the caller says, he's sort of a breath of fresh air. When Mitt Romney makes a gaffe, it's because he's changing a position or seems to be reversing a position. When Cain makes a gaffe, it seems to be that he has just misspoken. It's not a matter of changing convictions. A lot of people have suggested, though, that this is not a serious campaign. They've pointed to the fact that he's been hawking his book, that he's been giving paid motivational speeches on the side even while campaigning, and to the sort of lack of organization that is apparent in a lot of the early states. His campaign says they do have organizations, but sort of, you know, Republican operatives seem to be at a loss and really question whether or not he has the infrastructure to really capitalize on those poll numbers you cited.
Steve, how do you look at this question of whether or not he's really serious about it? You've got people like Stephen, again, who've listened and said absolutely, but others look at, I mean, for all his success, exactly whatever it was with Godfather, this isn't a super rich man. I think I saw something shy of $6 million. That's a lot of money, but these days that's not super rich. You know, he could still be looking for a step up financially, or does that sound absurd to you? Is he a serious guy, genuinely, do you think, headed for the White House with serious intention of going there?
Well, I mean, he told me, you know, I said, well, if you, you know, at the time, of course, everybody was saying he can't make it. And I said, what if somebody offered you the vice president's job? He said, well, if you have the right nominee, he would consider it. And then he also said, you know, but don't get me wrong. He says, I'm going to be the nominee and I'm going to beat Barack Obama. Now, you take him at his word, that sounds pretty serious. And I'm not tuned into all the political operatives to know what, mm-hmm. what a campaign should look like. But he sounds serious to me.
And then there's the question of does he really have a handle on what – does he just misspeak when it doesn't work out? He challenged President Clinton on the accuracy of what he was saying. But here was a little bit from that New Hampshire debate, October 11th, where Juliana Goldman of Bloomberg tried to pin Herman Cain down on his 999 tax plan, which Cain has claimed is revenue neutral. In other words, would bring in just as much, not more, not less, than the country's bringing in now. Others said it's going to fall short, fall heavily on the poor, won't be enough to run the government. Here's Goldman and then Cain.
Mr. Cain, you say that your plan is revenue neutral, and last year the U.S. collected $2.2 trillion in tax revenue, but Bloomberg government has run the numbers, and your plan would have raised no more than $2 trillion. And even with that shortfall, you'd still be slapping a 9% sales tax on food and medicine.
The problem with that analysis is that it is incorrect. The reason is incorrect is because they start with assumptions that we don't make. Remember, 999 plan throws out the current tax code.
Well, there's that same word made him famous with Bill Clinton. But is it that easy, David Graham? It's incorrect. It's incorrect. I've got the right numbers. Have these numbers been run down all the way? He's already now talking about a 909.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see him retreating a little bit already. It's not just Bloomberg. Other analysts, including the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center, notably, have run the numbers, and they see it being, you know, really hitting low-income Americans very hard, and they see questions about the revenue. And Cain repeatedly, when pushed on this, that is his answer, is they need to do the math, they need to look at our analysis. And you see that starting to hurt him a little bit. I mean, he was the darling of fiscal conservative pundits immediately after 999, and then after these questions started to be raised, you see them backing off a little bit, raising questions. Conservative voters I spoke to were very concerned about the sales tax element of it. They felt that wasn't well thought through and the federal government shouldn't have that. And you see him backing off saying, well, actually, it's a 909 plan. If you're poor, the poor won't pay. But it raises questions about how he's expanding the tax base if he's also granting these tax breaks to the poor.
We'd like to put those questions direct to Herman Cain. We've invited him on. We'll see if and when that fits into his schedule. Tony in Iowa City, Iowa. Tony, you're on the air.
Buddy, I kind of like find his comment about, you know, if you're working and you ain't rich, offensive. I'm pretty happy with my means of survival. I feel a threat because of the fact that, you know, as long as you can take a $15 an hour job and ship the machines and the stuff to do the work over to China and turn into a 15 cents an hour job, and the fact that nobody is talking about that as being the real true problem as to why Europe's having trouble, we're having trouble. That's the kind of point that nobody's really hitting on that.
Yeah, we've got a real economy out there, and it's one thing to say, you know, it's on you, but then when the jobs aren't there, they're not there. It was interesting, in an NPR interview this morning, they were talking about and with Bruce Bartlett, who served as a policy advisor in the Reagan White House. He said the ideas behind the progressive tax code, where the rich pay more than the poor, have lost ground since the 1980s. Here's NPR's Scott Horsley summarizing.
People have come to believe that it's okay for very rich people to pay virtually nothing, and they seem not to care when people like Herman Cain talk about massively raising taxes on the poor and the middle class. This is really quite astounding because There are certainly far more poor and middle class people in this country than there are rich people, but many people who would be worse off appear to support them.
Well, that is Bruce Bartlett, after all. I'm sorry I misspoke. That was the policy advisor in Reagan's White House with that observation. I mean, David Graham, how do you see this playing? You know, the impact, many are saying, would be very regressive, fall much more heavily on the poor. You've got other interpretations on that. Lawrence Kotlikoff is out saying, no, it's going to hit the rich. But Herman Cain doesn't seem to have a problem with putting that right out there, just put his chin out with it.
That's very true. I mean, he did make, as I said, he's made the one concession suggesting that the poor won't be hit as hard. But I think that it comes again to the idea that people don't calculate how it affects them immediately, but they do see a tax code proposal that they understand. They see what it would mean, even if they haven't done the math and realized, oh, I'm going to pay $2,000, $3,000 more in taxes total over the year.
Let's go to John in Boston. John, thanks for calling.
Yeah, Herman Cain simply doesn't understand easy math.
He's a mathematician.
Well, then can you tell me how he can take facts like we haven't grown the number of jobs right now. We're at the same number of jobs as in 1999, but the working age population has grown by 4.3 or 4.5%.
So how are you supposed to just go out and get that job?
So how are you supposed to go out and get those jobs that don't exist? And if business is supposed to be the ones that are, you know, creating all these jobs, why do they have somewhere near $2 trillion in cash reserves here in the U.S. and another $1.5 to $2 trillion in Europe that they're not using? You know, never mind what Tony said about how they're exporting jobs and getting tax breaks for
it. Yeah, you just don't see it adding up, even in a mathematician's hands there. Steve, Mitt Romney responded along a similar line, actually, saying, you know, simple solutions are nice, but they're not always up to the challenge. If it comes down to these two, if that's what it is, how do you, Steve, see the Herminator and Romney sort of stacking up in the GOP contest?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a political prognosticator. I know that it seems to me like the economic plans and the tax plans, to some extent, are intended to get elected. And what happens when the next person takes office or President Obama continues, that's a sort of another thing. You know, flat tax idea has been around a long time and hasn't made it in.
Hasn't made it in, but now, and maybe because Cain pushed it and did well in the polls, now Rick Perry's got his flat tax. We're going to talk about that later in this hour. I mean, it's catching in that way, Steve.
Very true, and you know, ideas percolate in elections. That's why we have them.
Steve Jordan, stand by there in Omaha, Nebraska. David Graham in New York City. We're talking this hour about Herman Cain at the top this week of GOP polls. He likes to hear from Krista Branch. She sings I Am America, kind of a Tea Party anthem. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
You stuff your pockets while Rome is burning. I've got a feeling that the tide is turning. I am America. One voice, united we stand. I am America. One hope to heal my
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Herman Cain at the top this week of GOP polls. Mr. 999, looking at his life, his record, his politics. This is an interview with Chris Wallace on Fox News in May. Herman Cain appeared confused when asked a question about the Palestinian right of return. In a later interview with Sean Hannity, Cain conceded he'd been caught flat-footed, but also claimed that his willingness to admit his ignorance about some subjects was actually a strength.
Chris caught me off guard. I didn't understand the right of return. That came out of left field. And of all the questions that I anticipated him asking me, I didn't even conceive of him asking me about the right of return. I now know what that is. The thing that you're going to learn about Herman Cain, if he doesn't know something, he's not going to try and fake it or give an answer that he doesn't know what he's talking about.
not going to try and fake it. David Graham, what about this man and his body of knowledge? I mean, he ran a pizza company. He headed up the Restaurant Association. He's done other things. Does he have enough background to be president of the United States? What do people say?
I think there are deep concerns among sort of establishment Republicans about what he knows and whether his lack of knowledge would really handicap him in a general election against Barack Obama. You know, he understands his fiscal conservatism. It's clearly a long-held belief. But others of his beliefs seem a little bit more recent. As late as 1999, he was talking about he wouldn't give a position on abortion. He thought affirmative action should be kept if tweaked. He felt that school vouchers were wrong. By 2004, when he was running for Senate in Georgia, he's suddenly a social conservative, very strongly pro-life. He supports school vouchers. He thinks affirmative action should be abolished. And in the presidential campaign, he showed that he doesn't have a deep base of knowledge about foreign policy. On Afghanistan, he said, well, I'll let you know once I'm in the White House and I've seen the documents. So it raises questions about how much he knows and how serious he really is about the world.
Here's Kane. He's made a number of different kinds of statements on abortion, though his big policy statement is absolutely pro-life. In practically all circumstances, John Stossel of Fox Business had difficulty pinning Kane down here within a single interview. You'll hear Kane first.
People shouldn't be just free to abort, because if we don't protect the sanctity of life from conception, we will also start to play God relative to life at the end of life.
So I'm confused on what your position is.
My position is I'm pro-life, period.
If a woman is raped, she should not be allowed to end the pregnancy?
That's her choice. That is not government's choice.
Good.
I support life from conception.
So abortion should be legal?
No, abortion should not be legal. I believe in the sanctity of life.
I'm not understanding.
And there's the choice word right in the middle. Charlie in Evans, Georgia. Charlie, you're on the air.
How are you doing?
All right. What do you think?
I'm a Herman Cain supporter, have been for a long time.
Why?
I think the man, well, several reasons. One is he's going to get rid of a lot of stuff that impede my business. I sell heavy construction equipment, and the EPA kills people in this business. Barack Obama's economic plans have killed people in this business, small people. All the people that have gotten any money out of the things that he's put out have been large corporations. No small construction business has gotten anything. And he preaches responsibility. That, to me, is the most important thing. We have a welfare state now, and we got to get rid of it.
Get rid of it and get rid of EPA regulations as well, I hear you saying, Charlie.
Yes, sir, that's right.
Get rid
of the EPA.
Okay, clear the way for the big equipment. There's the environment on the other side, but that's where Herman Cain comes down. Carl, thank you, Charlie. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on.
Okay, let's not have clean air, let's not have clean water, and let's not support the poor. That's very, very Christ-like. But anyway, one of the biggest problems that I have with Herman Cain, in particular as a black person in America, is his comments about black people being on a liberal plantation and about black people being the majority of black people being brainwashed into voting for Democrats. And here's my thought as a black person in this country. He didn't ask me, so I'm going to give you all mine.
Okay.
I have two choices.
Mm-hmm.
I have a donkey over here in the corner, and I have an elephant over here in the other corner. Now, this elephant is going to dump on me if I stand under it every chance it gets. Every chance this big elephant gets, it's going to dump on me. I guarantee you that. So I'm going to ride this flea-bitten donkey as far as it'll take me. That's how I feel about the two parties in this country.
Carl, we've got it. If you forgive me, I want to bring in, I got one more voice here and not much time, but I appreciate your call. I've got to go to Atlanta, Georgia. And David Rice, he's a professor at Morehouse College, Herman Cain's alma mater. David Rice studies black identity. He's author of Balance, Advancing Identity Theory by Engaging the Black Male Adolescent. David Rice, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hey, Tom, how are you? Thanks for having me.
We're well, and here we've got this prospect. Who knows what the next months are going to bring? But at the moment, we've got African-American Herman Cain at the top of the GOP polls, African-American Barack Obama in the White House. Might we see two African-American men contending for the presidency, David?
Well, I guess we might. I think the one thing that is very appealing about Herman Cain is he's entertaining. I mean, he's sensational. He talks in the third person. His rhetoric is tremendously catchy, and he doesn't present as particularly complex. You know, he talks in simple terms. But I think most importantly, kind of what the caller is nodding to, our previous caller, is that he's a black man who's hypercritical of another black man, Obama. And that gives license to the current cycle of conservative candidates to kind of go in on the Obama's personality and his present policies. So I think it's very interesting the field that we have presently, and to look at it as a reaction to Barack Obama's presidency, quite frankly.
There was a lot of talk back in the day about how African Americans saw Barack Obama. What about African Americans and Herman Cain? I know that there's not one voice here, but give us a sense of the perspectives that you see.
Well, I think that that's the thing that's particularly interesting is Herman Cain is not the first black conservative. I mean, certainly Alan Keyes ran for president in 96, 2000, 2008. Michael Steele, of course, was chairman of the Republican National Committee. We have Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Clarence Thomas. I think the thing about Herman Cain is that and other conservatives, and certainly I don't want to paint them all with one broad brush, but I think that him being in such a celebrated role presently allows us to begin to do the hard work of looking at what race means in America. I think that with the election of Barack Obama, there was a lot of discussion and perhaps pining for and wishing that we were post-racial, and we found that that's not quite the case. And I think that when we have black folk of different ilk presenting themselves and we get to look at what race means to them, what race means in their particular narrative, it allows us to be responsibly complex in how it is that we look at black folks and how it is that we look at other marginalized populations. So in terms of how black folks feel about Herman Cain, I mean, it can run the gamut. Certainly there are black folks who celebrate him, and certainly there are those who wish him not to do well in this present cycle.
Do you see him as a flash in the pan, David Rice? He's an alum, but do you see him as a short-term thing, a kind of phenomenon of the moment while the GOP wrestles around with its options, or as a go-the-distance guy, a serious contender?
You know, I think I think that's such an interesting question, and I think in the current context of America, it's difficult to pin things down. We're going through such interesting transitions. And if you ask me that question about Barack Obama during the last election, I don't think that I thought he was going to be president of the United States. So for me to suggest Herman Cain as a flash in the pan, I think perhaps would be irresponsible on my part. But what I can say is that he presents an interesting opportunity for us to kind of deconstruct, again, who he is in terms of a broad narrative and who he represents for other individuals. Because obviously, folks are invested in him. And so it becomes our responsibility as responsible participants of the body politic to see why is this the case? And is this somebody that we really need to vote into the White House?
David Graham, you wrote the cover story, Citizen Cain. Not a pundit, but give us your best guess 6 months from now. Are we going to see Herman Cain still, jostling up front in this GOP lineup, or, you know, off the charts?
It's hard to imagine a candidate with so little structure, such a money deficit, and so little experience going the long way. But as you said, his numbers are up, and despite a few gaffes in the last few weeks, he just seems to keep sailing. So it's really very hard to say.
A man the country's watching, David Graham with Newsweek, author of Citizen Cain. Thank you for being with us today, David.
Thank you.
Steve Jordan with the Omaha World Herald in Nebraska. Steve, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
David Rice at Morehouse College, Herman Cain's alma mater. Professor Rice, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Here's a little bit of Herman Cain from his 1996 gospel CD, Sunday Morning, The Man Likes to Sing. In a moment, Rick Perry's flat tax plan. This is On Point. In Gray Court, South Carolina yesterday, Texas Governor Rick Perry laid out his flat tax plan.
Today I lay before the American people my cut, balance, and grow plan. It cuts taxes, and it also cuts the spending. And it balances the budget by 2020, and it grows jobs and it grows the economy.
Does all that, says Rick Perry. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is Dave Montgomery. He's bureau chief in the Texas Capitol for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. He's been following Governor Rick Perry's run for the White House. Dave Montgomery, welcome to On Point.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Herman Cain's got 999. Take us into what Rick Perry, Governor Perry, is laying out here, Dave.
20% optional flat tax is the centerpiece of a broader economic plan that's going to also cut federal spending, reform entitlements, and do a lot of other things that is designed to stimulate growth. Obviously, the centerpiece and the most talked about component is the 20% optional tax plan. You can either opt for that, or you can continue filing your taxes under the 3-million-word, 75,000-page tax code that we currently have in place.
I can see the political advantage of making it optional. Then nobody's too worried about it, but they're hoping for the best. But how on earth do you calculate the impact of a plan that's got the centerpiece as an optional piece? You can stick with the old plan, or you can go with the new flat tax rate. You choose, Mr. or Mrs. Taxpayer. How do you calculate how that turns out, Dave?
Economists right now are still burrowing into it from all political sectors, trying to figure out exactly what the impact would be. Undoubtedly, it would offer a break for the wealthiest, who now pay 35% under the current six bracketed system. So they're almost certain to go for the 20% flat tax.
And those poorer Americans, who many have said would be hit by, let's say, 999, because they'd go from zero taxes to 9%, or at least they would before Herman Cain began to bring some nuance into this. What about under Rick Perry's plan? They could opt out of the new thing and stick with where they are right now?
They could, and Governor Perry's plan also raises the individual exemption to $12,500. The Wall Street Journal noted today that would free families of four with an income of $50,000 from paying taxes. So that could be a big boost and a selling point in Perry's side.
What about corporate tax rates in the Perry plan?
Would fall to the same level, 20% from a current 35% now. And as I say, Governor Perry's pushing this to basically free up, increase federal spending, get government off the backs of corporations and businesses. And his goal is nothing less than balancing the federal budget in 8 years by 2020.
That sounds terrific. Also, like a big cliff to climb. What about sales tax? Herman Cain would bring in a 9% sales tax on top of whatever else is out there. Any role for that in the
No sales tax. That's one of the lightning rods for Cain and his proposal that the conservatives have jumped onto is the sales tax. A lot of conservatives like the flat tax component, but they don't like the creation of a new tax, the sales tax.
And take us around to Social Security and Medicare. Governor Perry is looking there, too. What would he do?
For Social Security right now, as you know, Governor Perry's described it as a Ponzi scheme, which has attracted criticism from his opponents. But he points out that he'd protect benefits for those about to enter the system or now on the system. He'd look for a restructuring later. He would like to create an option for private investment by younger people. He's worried that the future of the Social Security system is in trouble. He would also propose raising the retirement age for both Social Security beneficiaries and Medicare beneficiaries. A lot of that will probably be fleshed out later.
President George W. Bush, also a former Texas governor, tried very hard to push that kind of Social Security change when he was in the White House. Does it feel to you, Dave, like the public's ready for that now, more ready than when President Bush put in so much effort only to see it go nowhere?
That's going to cause him real problems in the general election. Democrats have made Social Security one of their protecting Social Security, one of their foremost goals, and they're going to hammer him really hard if he becomes the nominee and pushes this. A number of other Republicans would like to take a look at this. Herman Cain, for one, is also expressed an interest in some sort of private option.
Have you spoken with economists about how they do run the numbers on the Perry plan? Does it add up?
I'm seeing mixed opinion on this. The Wall Street Journal, the conservative Wall Street Journal, tended to find some merit in it and said it's certainly worth a look. The other economists say, one, it's definitely going to reduce revenue, and they say it's kind of counterproductive toward Perry's goal of balancing the budget in just 8 years. Others say that he kind of missed the boat on a true overhaul of the tax system, and by keeping the current one in place while allowing an opt-in for flat taxes.
Dave, you know Austin, Texas well. You know Rick Perry well as bureau chief there for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. His numbers are way down now after coming in so strong in September. New York Times, 6%. Another poll here, 4%. How do you think he'll respond to that? You know, might he just say, I don't know, he's made a big announcement yesterday, but might he just say, forget it, I'm out of here? Or is he a hang-in guy?
He's a hang-in guy. Got that old West Texas stickability. He's also got he's taken steps to try to boost his fortunes. He's brought in a team of added advisors, including George W. Bush's former presidential campaign manager in 2000, and he's hoping this economic proposal is going to catch fire too
and help him out right there. Dave Montgomery with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram in Austin, Texas. Thank you for joining us, Dave.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Good to have you. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.